It's time, Fort Wayne. Your sports, your station. It's the Sports Rush with Brett Rump.
Three ball, Max Landis.
Covering all the topics that hit a nerve here in the Summit City.
Clark, 11-yard touchdown.
Only on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Now, here's your host, Brett Rump.
The greatest, most interesting, most important person of all time.
You are
Just when I think you've said the stupidest thing ever, you keep talking. I think that's the worst thing I've ever heard.
The simplest way to put it, I have problems.
Welcome to the alleged show.
Y'all ready for this?
Thank God it's
You can put the work away. It's time to head home into a sports weekend. The Sports Rush, your daily local sports fix, 4 to 6. I am Brett Rump, along with Adam Lundy. And we've got you connected on the Parkview Sports Medicine text line at 46862. We got a big hour on tap, including a conversation with Colts play-by-play voice Matt Taylor, coming up near the bottom of the hour. Well, it is Masters weekend in Augusta. I love the Masters. Number one, it's a transition period. When you see the Masters on television, you know that we are now moving away from winter and into spring. It's great to see all the beautiful flowers, the green grass. I mean, it just, to me, it gives us a sign of what's soon to be here in the great Midwest. It's also one of the greatest challenges in golf. And today it's been made even tougher because of 20, 25 mile per hour winds. But, man, Scottie Scheffler is going to be so tough to beat this weekend. I mean, Bryson DeChambeau has been hanging up there at 7 under. And now Scottie Scheffler has tied him also at 7 under. But who do we trust more to stay in that position? Bryson DeChambeau, to me, could all of a sudden start yanking every drive 10 yards deep into the woods on each side. I mean,
we saw him in the Pine Needles earlier today.
He can totally lose it with the driver. So I don't trust DeChambeau to keep this up. Scheffler, I do trust. But Max Homa is playing the tournament of his life as he tries to win a major. He is 6 under. And then you drop down 2 strokes from the top 3. And you got a group, a couple of guys at 4 under. There's a couple of guys at 3 under. So, really, there's a lot of separation. I mean, DeChambeau and Scheffler are doing something that very few golfers on the course are doing, and that's taming Augusta under terrible conditions. And I don't mean terrible in the fact that it's raining. It's a beautiful sunny day, but it's cold. It's dry. That means the greens get like lightning quick. And you've got the high winds, which certainly affects putts. It affects ball flight. And the thing about Augusta is your approach. And that's why you need to keep the ball in the fairway off the tee. You don't necessarily need to power it 340 yards. But you do have to keep it in the fairway so you've got an approach shot that you can control. You get it into the right position so you can get a nice angle. Because if you don't reach the right quadrant or section of the green, you could 3-putt very easily, maybe 4-putt.
Yeah, I mean, that thing could roll right off.
Well, let's talk about rolling off.
Uh-oh.
I got to find the name of the guy who did this earlier today. I don't know if you happen to see this, but 3 consecutive shots from in front of the green.
Uh-oh.
Where he flipped it up with the pitching wedge.
Yep.
Thigala. It was Thigala. 3 consecutive times, he chipped it up toward the front of the green. And 3 consecutive times, it rolled right back down the hill, right back to where he was standing. He was about 10 to 15 yards short of the green, off to the left side, and he was chipping it over to the right side. The pin placement was toward the front of the green, and instead of just safely getting it past the hole, 3 times he tried to chip it up and get it to stop at the hole, and instead it hit just on the edge, came back, and rolled all the way down the hill. And it's one of those long rolls down the hill.
You just curves. Have to watch it.
It ends up coming right to his feet.
Yeah.
And so 3 times in a row, he had to shoot from the exact same spot. I mean, that's the way you allow Augusta to beat you. Sometimes you got to take your medicine and move on. You know, a bogey's not the worst thing at Augusta.
No.
But it's the triple bogeys and worse that cost you. And the gala, what is the gala now? The gala is at 4 over par. Now, it does look like he might be able to make the cut line.
Wow.
a pair of 74s. But for some of the big names on the leaderboard, they're bunched around even par, to be quite honest. Patrick Cantlay is 1 under. You've got Schauffele. Xander Schauffele is at even par. He's through 10 today. You've got Tiger Woods at 1 over, which ties him with not only Rory McIlroy, who is 1 over par. He's on number 10 right now, but also Phil Mickelson.
Yeah, Phil.
Who is through 13 today at 1 over par. By the way, Brooks Koepka, who a lot of people think that, you know, he's the guy to always watch for when it comes to a major, he's actually 1 shot behind the trio of Woods, Mickelson, and McIlroy. And Justin Thomas is also at 1 over. And Koepka right now at 2 over. And Koepka has completed his second round. He shot a pair of 73s in the first 2 rounds. But it does look like Koepka is going to be safely under the cut line. So it does look like all of those guys are going to make it into the weekend.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the names past the cut line, and it's kind of surprising, too, just seeing some of the names past the projected cut line. I'm looking at Victor Hovland at +6. I'm looking at Ricky Fowler, +7.
Well, here's what's crazy. I don't know what Hovland has done today.
Let's see.
But Hovland shot a 71 yesterday. He was 1 under starting today. And as of right now, through 9 holes, he's 7 over par on the day.
Wow.
Yeah, Hovland so far today, let's see, he's got a bogey, double bogey.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just fall apart there.
Yeah, he has. +7 on the front nine.
Man.
And that's the way that's why I say Bryson DeChambeau, I just don't trust him. He could easily be Victor Hovland tomorrow.
That's what the Masters can do to you.
Yep. All right, 46862. If I was to give you an option, and when I say you, I'm not talking specifically to you, Adam. I'm talking to our listeners. If I gave you the option of taking Scottie Scheffler or the field, what are you taking, knowing what we know right now? That Scheffler is tied for the lead with DeChambeau. Scheffler came into the tournament as the favorite. If I give you a bet and give you Scheffler or the field, which side are you going on? 46862, the Parkview Sports Medicine text line. I'm very tempted to take Scheffler. I just don't know anybody that's going to beat him.
Yeah, you think he's just locked in and he's not going to let anybody catch up to him.
I just feel like Scheffler will not beat himself. He might get a bogey, but he'll plod along with some pars, get a couple birdie looks, make a putt here and there. And, you know, if he gets to 11 or 12 under, I almost feel like it's game over. There's nobody on the board that I think is going to shoot a pair of 65s or 66s and make up 12 shots in the weekend.
Yeah, fair enough. So
what would you do, Scheffler or the field? By the way, whoever made up the pairings at the Masters, that was nasty, putting Scottie Scheffler with Xander Schauffele.
Ooh.
Scheffler and Schauffele.
Scheffler
and Schauffele.
Whoa, a little tongue
Scheffler
twister.
Scheffler and Schauffele. In a featured group today. 46862. Like it or not, Caitlin Clark has already changed the WNBA. Seems like there's so much of the players in the WNBA that are so afraid of Caitlin Clark, and it's not going to be the same for her when she gets to our league and all. But she has already made huge, substantial changes to the WNBA. Number one, you've got Las Vegas. The Aces, best team in the league, they had to move their game from a 12,000-seat arena, which you would think in the WNBA would be plenty of seats, to a 20,000-seat arena. They'll play at T-Mobile Arena, which is the arena where the Las Vegas Golden Knights are playing.
Very cool.
You also have the television networks that have now picked up national broadcasts of 36 Fever games this year. We talked to Pat Boylan about that yesterday.
Yeah, we sure did. And we talked about some of these national games getting picked up for the Fever. It's just a lot of hype. A lot of hype and a lot of excitement, a lot of people wanting to get their eyes on Caitlin Clark in the WNBA.
Yep, and that will become official on Monday when the WNBA holds their draft.
Yes, it will become official.
Not much to have as a draft preview.
You start at number two.
You start at number two. We can just go ahead and pass on number one. 46862. Coming up tonight, Tin Caps Baseball, 7 o'clock. And tomorrow, don't forget, if you have a ticket for tomorrow's game, it's going to be a doubleheader starting at 1 o'clock. Same start time. But if you're, don't go out there and not know that you need to hang around a little extra time and that the game is going to end at 7 innings. It will be a 7-inning game at 1 o'clock, and then 30 minutes after the first game ends, game 2 will begin. And then Sunday, the series finale at 1 o'clock out at Parkview Field. All of the coverage right here on the radio with Mike Moss on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Got to take a quick break. We're going to come back. Guess who's behind a lot of the conference realignment, trying to make sure certain teams end up in certain conferences and are willing to put some cash on the line to make sure it happens. We'll tell you the reports that we're hearing next right here on the Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. If you missed our first hour, one thing you did miss was Kentucky does have their coach. That white puff of smoke coming on the top of Rupp Arena is signifying that Mark Pope is going to be the next coach of the Kentucky Wildcats. Yeah, eventually they got tired of people telling them no, so they went out and found somebody that was a guaranteed yes. Mark Pope was a team captain at Kentucky back in 1996, coached at BYU the last couple of seasons, so I guess they figured he's got enough experience and success for us, and we know he'll say yes. So we're going to just avoid all the public embarrassment of going after people that apparently don't think of this job like we do and hire Mark Pope as the next coach of Kentucky. Your thought, Adam?
Yeah, it's kind of like they didn't get any of the guys they actually wanted, so they went and get an alumni hire. I kind of get that vibe a little bit. A lot of Kentucky fans very unhappy with the hire. I think he's a good coach. I just think there's going to be a lot of pressure on him.
Well, like I told you earlier, this was not the marquee name that you'd expect.
Right.
And that if we were to talk about Kentucky a year or two ago, and talk about that job becoming open, we would have gone through the list of who's who in college basketball and assume that all of them would have some level of interest in going to Kentucky. And what Kentucky found out, they're not what they think they are.
No.
And they got turned down. Dan Hurley thinks he's got a better thing going at UConn right now.
Hard to blame him.
You know, Nate Oates likes what he's got going in Alabama, plus a lot of money to buy him out.
Yeah.
You've got Scott Drew, who he was very interested, but like a texter pointed out, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a decision that Scott Drew made with his family, and you assume that all the coaches probably have some impact from the family. Scott Drew's family situation, daughter goes to Baylor. In fact, I think she's like scheduled to maybe graduate in the next year. And then you had a couple of other boys, I believe, that are like in high school age. They've never gone to a different school, different community, mm-hmm. because Scott Drew's been at Baylor for such a long time. And ultimately, it was just a family that was not in unison about wanting to move to Lexington. And I think that Kentucky tried to give them their best pitch and bring them out to Lexington, bring the family, let them look around, see how beautiful it is. Look, you can see horses here. Well, I'm sure there's horses in Texas.
There might be one or two.
But the one thing that Lexington didn't have, that Texas did have, was Chip Gaines. What's the name of their show?
Oh, goodness.
Fixer Upper? Is that the show that they host?
Yep.
Fixer Upper?
Yep.
Yeah, it's made them millions of dollars.
Fixer Upper.
And Chip Gaines, a big supporter of Baylor Athletics, might have put a little extra money in the NIL kitty just for Scott Drew to stay. But anyway, after being turned down by some prominent coaching names, Kentucky gets Mark Pope as their next coach. 46862, Parkview Sports Medicine text line. We're also asking the question on Twitter or on X, formerly known as Twitter, and currently known as Twitter to me, because I don't change easily.
Old habits die hard.
Cheese Toasty or grilled cheese. It is National Grilled Cheese Day, and I have always grown up believing that that product of two slices of bread, cheese grilled in the middle with a nice little toasty golden brown crust, that is a cheese toasty. Adam informs me that he has known it only by one name, and that is a grilled cheese sandwich. What is correct? Is it a cheese toasty? Is it a grilled cheese? Adam, let's set our listeners straight. What do we got on the poll so far?
Yes, sir. Taking a look at our poll at 1380 The Fan on X. Excuse me. Is it a grilled cheese sandwich or a cheese toasty?
It's a cheese toasty.
As of right now, grilled cheese has the lead at 63.6%. Only 36.4% of voters going with your cheese toasty.
See, it's a young audience that's on X. Apparently, it's an older generation thing to call it a cheese toasty. And maybe it's even somewhat regional. I don't know. Now, I did joke on social media that somebody said something about what's a word or phrase you only hear in Indiana. I said, the car wash.
Wash?
Yeah, yeah, because you got to wash your body. You got to wash your car. Make sure you get everything washed up real nice.
Oh, someone on the text line also throwing in a grilled cheese vote. 46862.
It's a cheese toasty, people.
Mm.
46862, Parkview Sports Medicine text line. So we're hearing this report, and I find this fascinating, and it just, again, goes to the big business of college athletics right now. That and we've heard the buzz about Clemson and Florida State wanting out of the ACC. So ESPN apparently is now involved behind the scenes having meetings with the ACC about what it would take financially for them to free up Florida State and Clemson to leave, but only if Florida State and Clemson leave to go to the SEC. Why? Because ESPN controls the rights of both the ACC and the SEC, and in fact, ESPN owns the SEC network and the ACC network, so they want to make sure that if those two schools are going to bail on the ACC, that they end up at an ESPN conference. They don't want them end up floating over to the Big 12 or some other conference, especially the Big 10. But anyway, so ESPN behind the scenes apparently is trying to negotiate and broker a deal where money would be given to the ACC for the ACC to release Clemson and Florida State and make sure that Clemson and Florida State go only to the Southeastern Conference.
This is weird.
So now networks
who
pay the rights, and then as part of it, there also would be a guaranteed renewal of the television deal for the ACC, the remaining teams that stay in the ACC, which would guarantee the sustainability of the ACC conference without Clemson and Florida State. And that contract would be renewed then through the 2036 season.
Does this just feel kind of icky to you, just having these broadcast companies deciding the fate in the future, dipping their hands in conference realignment?
We were just talking about the fact that it's money that drives college sports right now, and here's another example.
Absolutely.
Of the corporate world taking control of what they want these teams and where they want them so that they'll be on a certain network. And now ESPN, apparently, and this is according to reports, they're involved in negotiations with the ACC to see what it would take and what they could do to kind of negotiate and broker a deal that not only would provide some influx of cash to the ACC, but also guarantee the renewal of their television deal through the year 2036. ESPN says, if you let them do it and they go with the SEC, we will sign a deal with you.
Oh, geez.
To stay with you through 2036. ACC needs that assurance that they're going to have television money because the television money is what's sustaining the conferences right now. And so the ACC would be around at least through 2036, and then they could deal with it at that time. But
So we have broadcast corporations strong-arming and bribing.
Deciding what the conferences are going to be, basically.
That feels gross.
They're using their money and their influence to pick and choose who's going to play in what conference.
Don't like it, Brett.
46862. Give us your thoughts. 46862. Still coming up, Matt Taylor joins us on the other side of the break. Tin Caps baseball comes your way tonight. It is a Friday edition of the Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Welcome back to the Sports Rush, your daily local sports fix, 4 to 6. I am Brett Rump, along with Adam Lundy, and of course, the Parkview Sports Medicine text line, always open for your questions, comments, or suggestions at 46862. And of course, we've got the month of the draft is upon us. And so a lot of the news starts to focus toward the NFL now that the college basketball season's ended. And we've got Matt Taylor, the voice of the Colts, who is joining us right now here on the Sports Rush. Matt, number one, I wanted to get you on just to prove to people that you don't only work about 70 hours a year.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of people think you just show up on game day and you start talking football, but it's certainly more than that. It never stops. It never ends. And just like the NFL, man, it never goes away. The draft is here, and it's certainly the most exciting part of the offseason and the lifeblood of the league when it comes to roster construction. So it's a really busy and important time of the year coming up.
What is it like? Take me through the process of putting together a draft. Like at this point, is it the scouting is kind of complete? Do they have a certain draft board with a certain number of names on it that they're trying to complete interviews? What is the process like behind the scenes? Have you ever peeked behind the curtain?
Well, I've been able to see the finished product after everything kind of all said and done, if you will. You know, Chris Ballard has let us come into the draft room and see not necessarily see their draft board, but be able to kind of like see their process once it's all said and done. That usually comes about mid-May, a couple of weeks after the draft. But you know, this time of year, you know, basically, all the evaluation is done. Obviously, everything in terms of watching the game film from last year's college season, that's well in the rearview mirror. The combine is about a month and a half old by now. You've got the pro days that have been completed for the most part. So there's all these different pieces to the puzzle that have been completed, and now it's just the scouts and the different personnel members for the Colts. You know, you got Chris Ballard and his assistant GM Ed Dodds, and so on and so forth. Now they're getting in the war room, getting inside that draft room, and they're really putting that draft board together and trying to come up with a consensus of, you know, this is how we rate the players. You know, these are the guys that we like, and you know, with these certain grades, you know, if this guy's not available, then we're going to go here. So really, draft night, honestly, is really not that pressure packed. It's really not that, it's not filled with anxiety that a lot of people think that it is, because all the homework is done in advance. And, you know, the draft kind of tells you where you're going to go. The board tells you, who you like and who you're going to pick based on the homework and your evaluation that you've done, you know, since January all the way to the end of April. So, it really is a fascinating process, but right now you've got the scouts, really kind of, you know, banging the table for their guys and trying to, you know, stand up for, you know, the guys that they've seen on, you know, sometimes tiny college campuses all around the country, saying, I think this guy might be a diamond in the rough, or this guy might fit, you know, this scheme or this kind of, tactic that we're trying to use here. So it really is a really interesting process. And, you know, last 2 years, really, the Colts have drafted a guy from Yale, in Rodney Thomas. They've drafted a guy from an NAIA school in Jake Wendt from Northern Michigan. They drafted Titus Leo out of Wagner. So there really are a lot of diamonds in the rough in this process, no stone unturned. And so we're going to have seven picks. As of right now, anyways, the Colts have a pick in each of their seven rounds. And, every year it's really, really important to make sure you get it right, because if you get it wrong, especially at some pivotal positions, it can definitely set your franchise back. There's no doubt about that.
The reputation for Chris Ballard that he doesn't like to give up picks to move up, although it has happened, it just hasn't happened in that first round where there might be a name that the Colts would want to go after. But that decision to pick up the phone and make the call and maybe try to trade up, whether it's in the second round, third round, fourth round, you mentioned that the Colts have a list that they have ranked all of the guys that they want. How far below that ranking would the draft board have to be, or the draft have to be? So let's say they got a guy ranked 50th, and all of a sudden we're at pick 58, and the Colts don't come up till 65. How deep on a normal draft? Do you have any idea before Chris Ballard is tempted to make the call to go get a guy that just sits there and they've got him ranked much higher and they fear that he's going to fall off the board?
No, that's a really good question. And actually, that similar scenario played out a couple of years ago. Nick Cross, they had him rated very, very high. And I think the Colts were somewhere in round three, and they had like a low round three grade on him. And he just kept sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. And the Colts kept wondering, why is nobody going after Nick Cross? I can't believe Nick Cross is still there. And if you looked at the Colts board, there was a lot of distance, if you will, from Nick Cross's name to the next guy that they were going to pick. There was a big gap there. So they kept telling themselves, like, we got to go make this happen. You know, we covet this guy, and he's clearly the best player on our board. So they actually, in that instance, I think that was 2022, just 2 years ago, actually traded up to get Nick Cross because of that exact scenario that you just mapped out there. So, again, the board tells you when you move up and when you move back. Obviously, that situation warranted a trade up and giving up some assets to get Nick Cross, who the Colts were, you know, convicted in, and they didn't want to lose him, and they were willing to give up some compensation to get a guy like that. And then, obviously, it works in reverse. When the Colts have a cluster of players with similar grades on them, and they say to themselves, we would be fine getting any of these guys, because there's not a big, you know, there's not much separation between, you know, just however you want to quantify a player A, player B, player C. That's obviously when you trade back, get another pick, because no matter where you're going to move back to, you know, what you're comfortable with moving back to, you feel okay because you're going to get one of those guys within that cluster, if you will. So that's basically draft 101. I mean, obviously that's an oversimplification of things. But again, if you do all the homework and you're prepared, I'm not saying the draft should be easy, but draft night should come with relatively no panic, if you will, if your draft board is set up and you're convicted about your grades and your evaluation on these guys.
Jim Irsay's role in the draft. Number one, do you know, is he going to be attending the war room and being part of the draft this year? And I don't know even if you know, if you can tell us. But number two, how much input does he really have? He an observer or is he active participant?
I don't know if he's going to physically be there this year, but in terms of input, it's going to be status quo, just like it always is. He's very much part of the draft, just like he's very much part of every decision that goes into the football operations side of things for the Colts. They don't make, and by they I mean Chris Ballard, in the past, Frank Reich, and obviously now Shane Steichen, they don't make any roster moves without Jim's blessing. And in fact, you know, I go back to the COVID season, you know, that pandemic draft that we had in 2020 when we basically all drafted from home, if you will, and watched the draft from home. You know, that was the year that Jim Irsay was pushing Chris Ballard. Chris Ballard was really convicted on Jonathan Taylor, and said, this guy's a difference maker. I think he can really help us. I think he can be, you know, a game changer for us. And Jim basically said, if you believe that much in him, go get him. You know, basically, like, what the heck are you waiting on? Go do it. And he did do it, obviously, and we know how well that's worked out for the Colts. So, yeah, Jim is very much involved, and he's a player in this. And he does get, you know, the I don't know what the right term would be, last right of refusal, but he's definitely you know, brought into the mix on all these decisions and into the decision-making process that Chris Ballard and Shane Steichen go through.
Colts, they drafted three corners a year ago, and it looks like corner is one of the priority positions this year. Can we expect that there's a possibility to see a corner in the Colts' first-round draft pick?
Yeah, I think it's a distinct possibility. I mean, you never know. But, you know, again, the general consensus is that you're going to have so many offensive players go in the top half of the first round of the draft. I mean, you're going to have all those quarterbacks. Heck, you could have as many as four quarterbacks go in the top 10, maybe even five, you know, depending on how teams view J.J. McCarthy or Michael Penix Jr. You know, that obviously is the position that always gets kind of pushed up the board because of need and desperation. But you're going to have the wide receivers. You might have a couple of offensive tackles go in the top 10. So basically in saying that, you're going to have some of the elite premier defensive players be pushed down in the middle of the first round available to teams like the Colts. So I think it just kind of boils down to positional depth. You know, if you look at the wide receiver position and cornerback, I mean, certainly cornerback's not nearly as deep as the wide receiver pool in that, you know, you can get a wide receiver on day two, maybe even day three, that can come in and be one of your top three wide receivers next year as a rookie. It's that ample. But, you know, you're going to have guys like Quinyon Mitchell or Terrion Arnold that might mm-hmm. be there. And, again, the cornerback depth is not nearly as deep as wide receiver or maybe offensive tackle. So that might be, you know, a sense of urgency for the Colts, knowing that maybe they can get a playmaker that catches the ball later in the draft, but knowing that, hey, we got to strike while the iron's hot here to get one of those difference makers in the secondary. And you're right, they're very, very young in the secondary last year with, you know, Juju Brents, who missed 8 games. You had Jalen Jones, who was a 7th-round pick. Obviously, they got to solidify that secondary for next year because they're playing a whole different group of quarterbacks and much improved schedule of quarterbacks next year compared to last year. They got to solidify, you know, not giving up so many big plays. They got to keep that point total down. Last year, I mean, each of the last 2 years, the Colts have finished 28th in scoring defense. I just think there's too much talent on that side of the ball for that to be the case. So if you have the chance to, you know, get a young, you know, shutdown corner or a guy that you believe in very much to come in and compete in this Gus Bradley defense, that might be the way to go for the Colts. But again, you never know how that board is going to shape up. You don't know Chris Ballard's evaluation on things. But again, that's just kind of the general consensus of, you know, the cornerbacks might be there and you might be able to get some playmakers later in the draft.
How much what the other teams in the AFC South are doing, did the Colts adjust their strategy? Does it adjust at all, like we're looking at what the Texans obviously are doing? Do you have to counter that? Do you pay attention to the roster, where they're bringing in some top veterans? Does that do anything as far as what the Colts are doing with the offseason?
No, I think that's a really good question, and I think so. I don't think it's, you know, it might not be the end-all, be-all, but I think it's definitely, again, part of the equation. I think it's part of the puzzle. I mean, if you look at the Texans, I mean, they're the team to beat. They are the defending AFC South champs, and they're not going anywhere, obviously, now with C.J. Stroud. He looks like the real deal, and, you know, they've spent a lot of money. I mean, I read where they spent, you know, almost 170 million guaranteed money on, you know, a guy with 100 catches, guy with over 1,000 yards rushing, and a guy with over 1,000 yards receiving. it's never been done in one free agency period in the offseason in the NFL. So they're definitely going for it, knowing that C.J. Stroud is, you know, a young kid, but more importantly, he's on a rookie contract, and they see this window of opportunity. So I think the Colts know that. I think they have to kind of draft to you know, in the back of their mind, you know that they're going to have to slow down C.J. Stroud. And again, that might be where the secondary thought comes into play, with possibly getting a defensive end or bringing in a corner. And something else too that's interesting about this draft as it relates to the division, you know, Jacksonville, again, I don't think they're going anywhere. I think they're going to be, you know, fully in the mix next season. They lost 5 of their last 6, you know, for a disappointing end to last season. But if you look at the draft order, the Colts are 15th, and then the Jaguars are 17th in round one. And then round two, the Colts are 46, and the Jaguars are 48. And the eerie thing is, if you look at their draft needs or just how they're constructed from a roster standpoint, they kind of have the same needs going into the draft: wide receiver, corner, edge rusher for both teams. You know, so maybe that's something to keep an eye on if you're Jacksonville. You know, if you love a player, A, you don't want that guy to go 2 spots in front of you to the Colts, because you're going to have to face that guy, you know, twice a year for 4 years on a rookie contract. Maybe you trade up. Maybe you leapfrog the Colts to make sure you get that guy, and more importantly, the Colts don't get that guy. And vice versa for the Colts. Maybe they feel they've got to be even more aggressive so they don't get leapfrogged by the Jaguars in the first round or the second round. So it really is a fascinating time of year. It's a season, you know, kind of into itself. There's so much strategy that goes into it, and I think that's why fans love it, because it's like a game within the game. There's a lot at stake, and there's a lot of different moving parts to it, and it's reality TV at its finest.
Let's talk about this weekend, the Masters, and if I gave you Scottie Scheffler or the field, which way do you go?
Well, I'm actually watching it right now on my TV as we speak, and I am not a golf aficionado, but just the way that guy's playing right now, I'm probably going to take him. I mean, I'm seeing the winds right now. There's so much gust, and guys are trying to figure out, you know, the conditions. They're trying to figure out how to, you know, to play this course right now with the weather. He seems to be one of the very few guys that's able to figure it out and can put up good scores no matter the conditions around him. So as of right now, you know, in the middle of Friday, give me him over the field. What about you?
I hesitate. It's like UConn going into the NCAA tournament. Do we really pick UConn even if we think they're going to win it? Because what's the chance they go back to back? But if you take the back to back or the multiple championships, I guess not back to back, but if you take the multiple championships at winning at the Masters, I agree with you. I think Scottie Scheffler's the guy to beat because he doesn't beat himself, and that's so important at Augusta.
Right. He's not going to have a three-hole stretch where it's bogey, 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 right?
Well, you know, I mean, remember when Tiger won in 2019? The entire field dumped it in the drink, and it just opened the door for Tiger, who didn't beat himself. And that's kind of what I see with Scheffler, is you're going to have to chase him, catch him, and pass him, because he is not going to come back to you. He just doesn't give up shots. I don't think he's got a bogey yet in this tournament. It's just crazy. Matt, before we wrap up, I got to ask you, of course, you had the call of the 1A state championship game. A few more people had the chance maybe to hear you than heard me, but we'll have to audit that. But let's talk about Canterbury. That was a pretty impressive performance, I thought, by the Cavaliers.
Yeah, it was a gritty game. I mean, I think the biggest lead in that game was like 7 points, which was the final margin, but yeah, it was back and forth basically the whole way. I was really impressed with, you know, their shot-making ability. And, you know, they didn't do very well at the free-throw line, but, you know, they didn't get down on themselves in that game, and they really kind of came together. Just a great story. I loved, you know, talking with Coach Adams up there, getting ready for the game, and I loved his mindset of, you know, we're the smallest school in a big city like Fort Wayne, and there's a lot of basketball tradition up there, a lot of great programs, that even though we're a 1A school, we're not going to back down from challenging ourselves in the regular season. I mean, I'm sure you saw it. Mm-hmm. Well, they had like 17 games in the regular season against teams that were bigger than them in classification, and they did pretty well for themselves. In fact, they didn't lose a single game all season, including the tournament, to a 1A team, which just kind of speaks to, hey, it doesn't matter what our record is going into the playoffs here, as long as we're tested and we gain some belief in each other, we're going to be okay. And you kind of saw that manifest itself throughout the course of that game. Got down, didn't panic because they've been there before. Kind of banded together as a team. I just love the coach. I love the story. It sounds like a great community there in Fort Wayne, and they've been a very successful athletic program. You know, I know the girls up there have 5 basketball championships, and they were clamoring for 1 in boys. And, you know, Coach Adams said after the game, hey, we finally got 1 up there in the Raptors that can join the other girls' banners, and rightfully so. That's something they're never going to be able to take away from them, their first state championship in boys basketball. That's a special group, and I think they're going to kind of pave the way for bigger things to come. But they're the first group, and that's a really special feeling.
Yeah, it's great, too. When I talked to Coach Adams after winning the championship, he was on the show, and I said, was there a moment where you looked at this team and thought, it is capable of winning a state title? He said, yes, in September, which is, I mean, that just says it all, right? He just believed from the moment they got together to start that year that this was a mission to win a state championship, and I think it all played out.
It's funny you said that, because he gave me a similar story, because I asked him, you know, what did you do to kind of bridge the gap, right? Because there was that weird week off because of the first round of the NCAA tournament at Cambridge Fieldhouse. You know, normally you're not playing, you know, they have that big gap, you know, 10 days or so between games. But he said, like, I budgeted for that. Like, when I built out the team schedule back in the fall, to your point, I knew what we were going to do during that week between games, because I knew we were going to get there. I saw this coming. And, you know, they had that influx of seniors, you know, the guys that came from Homestead that weren't eligible to play and then came in and just obviously provided a spark. But, yeah, great, great guy. Really happy for him. Just kind of getting to know him a little bit that week of the game. You know, sounds like he's just a lifer, a guy that loves it, loves to be a mentor for young people. And when good things happen to people like that, man, it makes you truly feel good. And that's the beauty of sports, man. It connects us all for great stories like that. And he's certainly, you know, a great story.
Have a great weekend. Appreciate the time. And we look forward to keeping in touch.
Yep, my pleasure. Have a great weekend.
That is Matt Taylor, voice of the Indianapolis Colts, joining us here on the Sports Rush. We'll take a quick time out and we'll wrap things up, get you into your sports weekend next. It's a Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Back a final time here on the Sports Rush, your daily local sports fix 4 to 6. Brett Rump, Adam Lundy, ready to head into the sports weekend. Plenty of sports coming up this weekend. Comets with a big final weekend of the regular season. Go K's. Got to win all three. Get yourself in those playoffs. They got the Indy Fuel coming up tonight, and Shane Alberani has the call on our sister station, 92.3 FM, whoa, and 1190 AM. Also coming up tonight, Tin Caps Baseball at Parkview Field. Mike Maz has the call. Be sure you tune in, because you might get a special guest somewhere along the way tonight. Yeah, you've got to listen. That's just the ultimate tease. You got to listen to find out who it might be. But check it out tonight right here, 1380 The Fan, 100.9 FM, starting with the pregame show at 6:45. If you happen to so desire, I'll be on the TV side tonight with John Nolan. Not that you'll be watching the game on TV, because you'll be listening to Mike Maz. But if you happen to be out at the ballpark, wave up at the TV booth. I'm sure I'll see you. If I didn't wave back, I didn't see you. But that's the rule we'll go by. Tomorrow, doubleheader. And then, of course, all weekend long, the Masters. We've got your Masters updates right here at 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Big thanks to our guest, Justin Cohn, heading into the final weekend of Comet Hockey. Also, thanks to Matt Taylor, voice of the Colts. Have a great sports weekend. Get ready for us. We're back on Monday, 4 to 6, with the Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM.